Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, people-powered radio, reporting from our hideaway studio in East County. Today, we open our show with a retrospective on the border fire that has charred its way across East County for the past week. We'll have the latest on evacuation closures and road updates, as well as a perspective on what went right, what went wrong, and some things that could be improved for the future. Then we'll tell you about a vote that could bring a grocery strike to stores across Southern California. In our national news today, the Supreme Court has voted to block President Obama's immigration protections, which could affect 500,000 immigrants across the United States. We'll have an in-depth look about just what you need to know about that landmark ruling. Here in East County, we'll have some information about new efforts to find the killer of Zusha Brown, a Sequan youth gunned down on a La Mesa freeway. Our newsmaker interviews today are with Jane Villa and Nancy Curran with the Mary Magdalene Apostles Parish here in San Diego, and you may be surprised that these are women who have been ordained as priests and who are fighting for the rights for women within the Catholic Church. From Public News Service, we'll have the top national and international news today, including the shocking outcome of a vote in Great Britain on leaving the European Union. From the County of San Diego, hear about where to find cool zones in East County, and we'll have news about a new cholera vaccine for travelers this summer. So stay tuned for all of these stories and more on today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show, where East County matters. This is Miriam Raftery with the latest on the border fire that scorched nearly 7,500 acres in San Diego's East County and is now 45% contained as of Friday afternoon. At a community meeting Thursday night at the Los Coches Creek Elementary School in El Cajon, where the evacuees were sheltered, fire officials gave a briefing on the fire that since Sunday has destroyed 5 homes and 11 outbuildings, forcing evacuations in Potrero, Lake Morena, and Campo communities. Those evacuation orders have all been lifted now, and residents can go home, though some road closures still apply. Residents voiced gratitude at the meeting toward firefighters for their valiant efforts to save homes and lives, also acknowledging much that has improved since the 2003 and 2007 firestorm, thanks to better investments in firefighting equipment and technology. But some voiced concerns over areas they hope to see improved, notably helping children and young teens forced to evacuate when parents were away at work, slow communications early on about the fire's progress, animals lacking food and water in the evacuation zone, and inadequate water at Lake Morena for firefighting aircraft due to the City of San Diego draining the reservoir too low. County Fire and CAL FIRE Chief Gary Croucher recalled getting a phone call on Father's Day last Sunday about the fire burning near Potrero in unprecedented 109-degree heat. He says the incident triggered an unprecedented response since historically Potrero has been the scene of several firestorms and it takes a long time to get resources into the remote area near the border. Back in 1940, a burn over at nearby Camp Lockett in Campo killed several soldiers. In 1973 and 1974, fires in the vicinity resulted in firefighter fatalities, and during the 2007 firestorm, a burn over in Potrero killed a civilian and injured 3 firefighters who suffered severe burns. During the border fire, the first engine arrived on scene within 12 minutes of a 911 call to the remote area. Soon after, 10 engines, 2 air tankers, and other resources were on the scene. Despite those efforts, the fast-burning fire jumped across Highway 94. Soon, 5 air tankers were there, along with several helicopters. Despite fires burning elsewhere in the state, including Santa Barbara and Los Angeles, thankfully, Captain Croucher says, they listened and gave us what we asked for. By 2:45, 70 engines had been ordered and a CERT team was also activated. Now, a recent East County Magazine investigation a couple of years ago found fire stations in those very same areas closed during fire season, resulting in funding decisions by the county to get them reopened and staffed after our report was published. Captain Croucher confirmed that during this fire, Every single station was covered, including those in Potrero, Campo, Lake Morena, and Boulevard. Yes, the very same ones we investigated. Dispatchers also backfilled all stations where firefighters were deployed to assure that other 911 calls would be answered as needed, he said. Michael Lavaria from CAL FIRE announced that Monday morning on day two of the fire, it again jumped across 94. The hot, dry conditions continued even through the night, and the terrain hadn't burned in years, so the fire spread swiftly. Air tankers dropped fire retardant, allowing the crews to finally get in on the ground from Buckman Springs Road to Harris Ranch Road. And then, Olivaria says, we started burning it. They lit a backfire to save many homes. By Thursday night, firefighters had a shaky containment, he said, adding that we won't be out of the woods yet for a couple of more days because shifting winds could once again jump the flames out of the containment line. Incident Commander Ron Bravo praised the cooperation among many agencies, noting we're relying on each other. He did apologize for the long time that some evacuated residents had to spend in shelters up to several days, but he said, we have to make decisions based on not losing any more property or lives. Supervisor Diane Jacob said she and her staff kept close tabs during the fire. She recalled that back during the 2003 Cedar Fire, when there were problems with lack of communications and resources, that led to lessons being learned. She praised the county for investing $350 million in improving communications, and the county now has 3 firefighting helicopters stationed here that were out battling the fire. But she cautioned that another fire won't be a matter of if, but when. She voiced thanks that there were no Santa Ana winds during the border fire, adding, those devil winds are what really hinder firefighters. Supervisor Jacob also announced some help for fire victims. That includes assistance with debris removal and a waiver of permit fees for rebuilding any structures that were legally permitted. Still, she acknowledged some problems did occur. We received emails about animals not being fed, she said, praising County Animal Services for responding once notified. But she added, the community has come together like nothing before to bring feed and water to animals in need. She said, I love the backcountry residents. The most dire needs arose in Potrero, where some residents who didn't evacuate were left without power, without landlines, or cell phone services. One resident with satellite was able to get on the internet and reached me at East County Magazine, alerting us that many animals were left without food or water by Potrero neighbors who did evacuate, as well as some who stayed behind to help others. But none of them could get water since the electric well pumps were not working in the power outage. Some residents told East County Magazine that they even climbed fences to aid animals trapped behind locked gates with no food or water. The owner of an organic farm reported finding dogs, pigs, and other animals throughout town that were starving, dehydrated, and in some cases already dead. Another reader reported an emu with burned feet and several ostriches seemingly abandoned. East County Magazine got word to county animal officials and a CERT team, who got some supplies in, but it's still unclear whether the ostriches or the emu survived. The Deerhorn Valley Antler editor in Hamul also organized relief caravans to help many animals in Potrero. The Humane Society and County Animal Services did succeed in rescuing many animals throughout the fire-stricken region, ranging from dogs and cats to horses, donkeys, and emus. One of the worst tragedies occurred at the CB Farms Chicken Ranch in Potrero, where at least 20,000 chickens died due to power being turned off, so that automatic feed and watering systems did not work, as our special report revealed. In triple-digit heat, many chickens swiftly perished. The owner of the evacuated ranch has voiced frustration because initially his workers were not allowed in, nor were water trucks or food trucks, and he was not allowed to hook up a generator until after many birds had perished. Other Potrero farmers posted on social media to voice frustration at not being allowed back into the area after they left to buy feed supplies and water to keep their livestock alive. But authorities with the sheriff and CAL FIRE both remained adamant about barring access from the evacuation zone due to concerns over the fire returning. Many praised Border Patrol agents for assisting to get supplies in for some stranded animals. Now, this morning, we heard from Kim Hamilton from the Deerhorn Valley Antler, organizer of relief efforts to bring water and supplies to animals in Potrero, and from Jan Headland, a Potrero Planning Group member who remained there during the fire. We learned that even though the roads are now open, power remains out in much of the area and could take a week or more to restore. Now, since residents rely on electric well pumps, and in some cases pumps burned, both people and animals will be needing large amounts of water for the foreseeable future up there. Potrero residents also have had to discard spoiled food from refrigerators, so supplies of non-perishable food donations are also needed. Volunteers are also in need to help deliver supplies to Potrero. To help, you can visit DeerhornValley.net, which is organizing some efforts, and the San Diego Humane Society, which helped rescue many of these animals, is also accepting donations. At Thursday's briefing, Supervisor Jacob revealed that her office has forwarded complaints to the district attorney alleging that the Potrero General Store raised prices for fire victims and engaged in price gouging during the disaster. County Fire Chief Tony Meacham said firefighter safety was a top priority during the blaze, but that any residents with concerns should talk to fire officials so the issues can be addressed. We're in for a long, hot summer, he predicted. Next came questions from the media and the public. A Potrero resident of many years, who has also served as a San Diego rural fire captain, said residents who had issues with animals in Potrero not being fed should shoulder some blame for the situation. He said, people need to understand that if you choose not to evacuate, you are on your own. You should have 3 days of everything you need, including feed and water for animals. But some of those animals were left behind by people who were outside of the evacuation area and had no way to get back in to care for their pets and livestock. Fire official Scott McLean said firefighting crews were also looking out for the animals when they found them and giving water to many. One Potrero resident asked how a 3-acre fire that officials initially reported having a good handle on swiftly grew into an inferno. Bravo said that with the drought, firefighters across the state are seeing things never seen before with brush burning faster, so travel time to get the resources on the scene fast is now critical. Chief Croucher said a controlled burn last winter helped create a fuel break around Lake Morena that helped save that community. Supervisor Jacob has spoken out to criticize the U.S. Forest Service for refusing to land its largest air tanker at the Ramona Air Base, flying it all the way from San Bernardino instead. The Forest Service has contended that the runway at Ramona is too small, but CAL FIRE repeatedly landed and took off from there with the same planes. Now, we asked Chief Meacham if that delay could have allowed the fire to spread more swiftly than necessary in those crucial early hours, but he said this was not the case since extra tankers were ordered to compensate for the delay in the tanker coming from San Bernardino. A Campo Hills resident at the meeting wanted to know when she could go home, stating, most of my belongings have been in my hot car for 2 or 3 days now. Upon being told that the evacuation order for her area had just been lifted, she broke into a big smile, and everyone applauded. Some residents complained about long delays and notifications from CAL FIRE during those early days of the fire. In the first 2 days, the agency went 13 hours the first night and nearly 16 hours the next without any emails, tweets, or other notifications to the public or press. Scott McLean, a CAL FIRE public information officer, explained we had no cell service at the base camp. Later, once cell service and internet were set up, the communications improved with frequent updates throughout the day and the subsequent days of the border fire. Bravo said fiber optics for cell phone service in Potrero were damaged so badly that even a temporary rig to connect to the tower didn't work, so firefighters had to rely on written notes to each other to communicate at times. Kendall Bordister, CAL FIRE's public information officer in San Diego, said he tried to stay in touch with tweets, but noted every news agency in town had this cell phone number. He said he received over 500 calls in the first 48 hours, and he praised the county's new 211 system as a helpful resource for people with questions during the blaze. A Hamul resident and San Diego Rural CERT team member said that ham radio operators also helped during the fire to get information to fire chiefs and CERT team members, and she said, classes on ham radio will soon be offered to the community. But a Campo resident made clear that some issues still do need to be resolved for the future. She said, a lot of parents were flipping out because when they were told to evacuate, they were at work an hour and a half away. School was out and their kids were at home. Children were getting other children out. Some 12- and 13-year-old children watching younger siblings were too young to drive and had no way to evacuate, she added, then asked, what can we do for the future? Chief Meacham said another community meeting will be held soon and asked her to get in touch with Captain Croucher about this issue. Echoing the Campo resident's concern, a new resident at Lake Morena told us that his daughter, who was too young to legally drive, took the wheel anyhow and drove out when the evacuation order came and Dad was at work. Some residents admitted to sneaking back into evacuation areas to retrieve medications or other belongings forgotten, not realizing that backfires had been lit, but fortunately avoiding harm. They asked if in the future CAL FIRE could alert residents when backfires are to be set. A Lake Morena resident raised an issue that she said is a thorn in everyone's side, and that's the City of San Diego's decision draining Lake Morena to below 3% of capacity for drinking water for city residents. She said the city also refused to fix a dam, and she told firefighters, you guys were sucking up mud. You were sucking up my neighbor's pond. Supervisor Jacob agreed with the resident's concern and said she's been working for several years to try and stop the City of San Diego from draining the lake, talking to mayors and council members, but so far without success. To the city, it's free water, but to us, it's all about having adequate water supplies for firefighting, she stated. Now we could have used that water during the fire. Perhaps these county residents may wish to stage a protest at the mayor's office to draw attention to how much the city's reckless decision to drain that lake imperiled lives and homes during the border fire. Jacob urged everyone to write to the mayor and city council in San Diego and let them know they want water levels restored at least partially in Lake Marina for firefighting. And she noted that since the Cedar Fire, everyone knows that with high winds, a fire that starts in our backcountry can burn all the way into San Diego. She called the city's actions very short-sighted. East County Magazine previously interviewed a city water official about the draining of Lake Marina a couple of years ago, and he admitted that the city did nothing to ask its own residents to save water before depleting Lake Marina's, advising us that they took the water just because they could. East County Magazine suggested at the meeting that a satellite for internet hookup should be installed at the Potrero Library and other remote locations in the future because Potrero lost all communications with outside world, leaving residents in a dangerous situation and even firefighters without communications. As previously mentioned, one Potrero resident did communicate via satellite internet hookup. And Bob Scheid, a resident of Lake Marina, later told us that he was also the only one in his community with internet since he, too, is on satellite service, while others on AT&T had no service at all. Supervisor Jacob urged all residents to download the San Diego County Emergency app and to sign up for Alert San Diego to be ready before the next fire strikes. Another resident voiced concerns over 10-foot-tall brush behind her property that hasn't burned since the 1970s. Bravo suggested she get involved with a local fire safe council since they can apply for grants for projects such as this, but he added, it takes a grassroots effort. Bravo praised residents who had cleared defensible space around their homes, adding that this helped firefighters during the fire. The incident commander for the border fire concluded, a lot of thanks goes to the citizens that are out there.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, in the heart of San Diego's East County.
Members of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union have voted overwhelmingly for a strike, Union President Mickey Kasperian announced Tuesday. No date for the strike has been set as yet by the union, which represents about 47,000 grocery workers across Southern California, including 10,000 employees here in San Diego County. If a settlement is not reached, the strike could affect the Ralph's, Albertsons, Vaughn's, Safeway, and Pavilion stores. The grocery chains have sought to cut holiday pay, reduce corporate contributions to pension funds, and make new employees work longer before getting raises. Currently, the starting wage is $10.10 an hour, though that will rise as California's minimum wage goes up to $15 an hour by 2020. Kasperian has called the company's latest offer insulting to workers and their families. He says, "We don't want to strike. We want to make a successful contract." The San Diego Union Tribune reports that Carlos Illingsworth, spokesman for Albertson and Vaughn's, says the supermarket companies are committed to negotiating a contract that will be, quote, fair to all parties. Kendra Doyle from Ralph's has called the strike's authorization premature and says it causes concern for associates and customers. Grocery chains risk losing market share if they face a protracted strike and many customers shop elsewhere to avoid crossing picket lines as occurred during the last strike over a decade ago. San Diego has a growing number of alternatives such as Costco, Trader Joe's, Smart & Final, Barron's Market, Sprouts, Whole Foods, Food for Less, Grocery Outlet, Stater Brothers, and smaller neighborhood family markets as well as farmers markets and retailers such as Target that now offers some grocery items. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Chisato Iverson.
President Barack Obama's executive orders to protect an estimated 5 million immigrants, or nearly half the 11 million undocumented immigrants in the United States, from deportation have been blocked by the U.S. Supreme Court. The action puts many immigrants brought here as children and parents of undocumented immigrants at risk of eventual deportation. Their fate now depends on the outcome of the next election. The High Court ruling also takes away new health care coverage recently granted by California to certain undocumented people. Here's what you need to know. The justices split 4-4 on the ruling due to the vacancy left on the High Court by the death of Justice Antonin Scalia. These are the two programs blocked by the tie decision in the case United States versus Texas. Deferred action for parents of Americans and lawful permanent residents, or DAPA, would have given temporary work permits to parents of U.S. citizens and legal residents. The other program is an expansion of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program, which gave a reprieve to certain people brought to the U.S. as children. The president's order would have helped young people who arrived in the United States before 2010 to be eligible for protection against deportation. Very important, the ruling will not affect those who came here before 2007, since they are already protected, The Hill reports. The decision by the Supreme Court is causing sadness and panic in immigrant communities. Antonia Bernabe, organizing director for the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights in Los Angeles, states, "This is really sad for the immigrant community. They are really disappointed, hoping for a real solution. Now they are still fearing for their families, fearing for themselves, living in terror every day," he said, Public News Service reports. Bernabe adds his community will fight on, including organizing to elect candidates at every level of government who support immigration reform, something that Congress has failed to pass for many years. Mark Arabo is the spokesperson for the Western U.S. Chaldean Catholic Diocese and for the Minority Humanitarian Foundation in San Diego, an organization that has rescued over 400 Iraqi Chaldean Christians from persecution in Iraq. The group hopes to help another 700,000 Christians facing persecution and genocide at the hands of ISIS, the Islamic State. San Diego is home to 60,000 or more Chaldean immigrants, many of whom have held rallies in El Cajon pleading for the American government to help their loved ones still in the Middle East. Back in 2014, El Cajon Mayor Bill Wells, a Republican, told 2,000 local Chaldeans at a rally in front of City Hall to tell their relatives fleeing the brutality of ISIS that if they can come here, they will be safe and they will be welcome. But today, they are neither safe nor welcome. Arabo called the Supreme Court action alarming for immigrant families everywhere, but it is particularly frightening for Chaldeans, he said. People who came here to escape religious persecution and extermination at the hands of ISIS are now being told they have to go back. They're terrified, he said in a statement issued Thursday. Thomas Sands, president and general counsel for the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund, argued the case before the Supreme Court in April. "That case is still alive," he said, "and it has two paths back to the high court for it to reconsider this decision. This is only a preliminary injunction, so it has to go back to the district court, that's in Texas," he noted, "and the judge there must reach a final decision." Sands adds, "That final decision could then end up back before the Supreme Court. In addition, right now there could be a petition for rehearing by a full court. That full court would occur after the next U.S. president fills the vacancy on the Supreme Court and determines the court's new majority." President Obama took the executive actions only after Congress repeatedly refused to approve comprehensive immigration reforms. The lawsuit before the Supreme Court was filed by 26 states, mostly under Republican control, seeking to block the protections against deportations for immigrant families. The ruling does not necessarily mean that deportations will begin immediately, however, since Obama previously directed Homeland Security to focus deportation efforts on criminals who broke laws other than coming here without documentation. Obama and some legal scholars have noted that the High Court did not rule directly on whether presidential executive orders themselves are constitutional or not, instead focusing on the specifics of the case, allowing or blocking deportations to commence while awaiting that trial court hearing in Texas on the original case. But House Speaker Paul Ryan issued a statement proclaiming, "Today Article 1 of the Constitution was vindicated. The Supreme Court's ruling makes the president's executive action on immigration null and void." Speaker Ryan, a Republican, added, "The Constitution is clear. The president is not permitted to write laws. Only Congress is. This is another major victory in our fight to restore the separation of powers." After the ruling, speaking at the White House, President Obama made clear that the future of the American dream for immigrants is at stake in the next election. The president said, "We're going to have to make a decision about whether we are a people who tolerate the hypocrisy of a system where the workers who pick our fruit or make our beds never have the chance to get right with the law, or whether we're going to give them a chance, just like our forebears had a chance, to take responsibility and give their kids a better future." Nearly two-thirds of all Americans, 63%, say the president's deferred action policy for young immigrants should continue, according to a Bloomberg Politics survey in November, making the High Court and the Republican majority in Congress clearly out of step with mainstream American views. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump has called for deportation of all undocumented immigrants with no exceptions. He praised the Supreme Court decision, stating on Thursday, "Today's 4-4 Supreme Court ruling has blocked one of the most unconstitutional actions ever undertaken by a president." He added that the split decision makes clear what is at stake in November, The Washington Post reports. Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton, however, says a tie vote by the Supreme Court blocking President Obama's immigration plan is unacceptable. She said the high court's action is a reminder of the harm Donald Trump would do to immigrant families and how much damage Senate Republicans are causing by refusing to consider Obama's Supreme Court nominee Merrick Garland. Mrs. Clinton said that as president, she would do everything possible under the laws to go further to protect families. The Senate's Republican leadership has refused to hold confirmation hearings on Merrick Garland or on any nominee proposed by President Obama, insisting that decision must be left to the next president, who will take office in January after the November election. The ruling also halts California's recent decision to allow undocumented immigrants protected under DACA from deportation to be eligible for state-funded health insurance through Medicaid. Governor Brown signed a law last year also allowing 170,000 undocumented children to sign up for Medi-Cal, and earlier this month, the governor signed another bill to let undocumented immigrants buy insurance through the state health exchange, although without subsidies that citizens would receive. Now, however, the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling will deprive an estimated 1.5 million Californians of opportunities for health care. The Los Angeles Times reports over half of our state's total of uninsured people. The Supreme Court decision on immigration will no doubt fuel record turnout among Latinos, Chaldeans, and other voters in immigrant communities this November. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
New freeway signs commemorating murder victim and Sikwan tribal member Zusha Brown Jr. were unveiled this week at the La Mesa Police Department. Brown was killed in a drive-by shooting while in a vehicle on Interstate 8 in La Mesa in the early morning on May 5, 2013. He was 22 years old. The shooting also injured Malcolm Hume, the driver of the Nissan Maxima in which Brown was a passenger. Police have said the case is believed to be gang-related, although neither Brown nor Hune had any known history of gang involvement. The murder remains unsolved. Sikwan Chairman Cody Martinez, Sikwan Councilmember Zusha Brown, District Attorney Bonnie Dumanis, and La Mesa Police Chief Walt Vasquez were on hand to unveil the memorial signs, which were being placed along Interstate 8 within 1 mile of where the murder occurred. Councilman Brown, father of the slain youth, said his son had a couple drinks and decided to ride home with someone else. He added, "Obviously, he was at the wrong place at the wrong time. He was trying to make the right decision for himself that night. Hopefully, someday, someone will grow up and understand the mistakes that they've done and take responsibility for the things that they've done. That's my goal and my hope." Sikwan also reaffirmed its commitment to offering a $100,000 reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of those responsible for the death of young Zusha Brown, a Sikwan tribal member. Reporting for the East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Chisato Iverson.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the Network for Social Justice.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the Network for Social Justice, recording at our Hideaway studio in East County. Recently, Pope Francis announced plans to establish a panel that will be studying the prospect of ordaining women as deacons, but so far he has stood by the Church's position opposing women priests. But you may be surprised that there already are some women who have been ordained as priests and who are fighting for the rights of women to be priests in a reform movement called Roman Catholic Women Priests. I have two of them with me here today, Nancy Curran and Jane Villa from the Mary Magdalene Apostle Catholic Community right here in San Diego. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Thank you. Good morning.
Now, I'm sure it surprises a lot of people to hear that there are some women that have been ordained. Can you tell us a little bit of the history of exactly how that came about? Jane, let's start with you.
In 2002, there were seven women who received some advice from an active cardinal in Europe that if they wanted to pursue women's ordination in the Catholic Church, they were going to have to do it themselves, follow the Episcopalian model, because it was not going to happen in the Vatican.
Yeah.
And so those seven women found two bishops who agreed to ordain them and ultimately went out on a ship on international waters on the Danube River and were ordained Catholic priests.
My goodness.
And that is the beginning of the movement.
And so how many people are in this movement today?
I think today there are between 150 and 200 in the movement. Mm-hmm. In the United States, we have over 100 priests.
Now, when and where were you ordained?
First, I was ordained in 2004 as a deacon on the Danube River, and then in 2006 as a priest on the Bodensee or Lake Constance.
Nancy, how about you?
I was ordained in 2009. My ordination was a little different from Jane's or from many other women and men who enter the Roman Catholic Women Priest organization. I was ordained by my community, and at my ordination, there happened also to be a bishop there.
Okay.
So, and the reason I was ordained by the community, our faith community, the Mary Magdalene Apostle Catholic community, was that there was a tradition, I believe that goes back to the 11th century, where communities called their own priests to ordination and to service. And so we were following in that older model, older tradition of ordination.
Very interesting. Now, how did the Catholic Church, the Vatican, officially respond to all of these women becoming ordained? What happened?
They excommunicated them.
Wow. When did that occur?
The first excommunications came on the Feast of Mary Magdalene about a month after the original Danube Seven were ordained.
And that was in?
2002.
2002. And then in 2009, I understand, it was a broader excommunication order given. Tell us about that.
So many women became ordained so quickly, and the movement started spreading throughout the world, that I think the Vatican was unable to keep up with the formal legal processes, which involved serving papers on individual women. So they issued a general order of excommunication for any woman who attempts ordination and any person who assists a woman, any Catholic who assists a woman in attempted ordination.
Wow, so they were really serious about stamping out this rebellion within the church. How did that make you feel when you were excommunicated? Were you expecting it, or did it come as a surprise?
It did not come as a surprise. I was expecting it, and at some level, it's a badge of honor. It's part of what we stand for, the mm-hmm. radical inclusivity of all people within the Catholic Church. But of course, the concrete realities are also painful.
Yeah, I'm sure that it must be. And is the same situation apply to you, Nancy?
Yes, it does. Although I did not get the formal papers, but yes, it applies to me too.
Okay. Tell us about the Mary Magdalene Apostle Catholic community here in San Diego. I understand that this is one of the largest branches anywhere of this movement, this Roman Catholic Women Priests movement. Is that correct?
My understanding is that our community, the Mary Magdalene Apostle Catholic community, is the largest Roman Catholic women priest-led faith community in the world.
How many people do you have in your congregation now?
On the rosters, if mm-hmm. you will, there are about 150. And any given Sunday, we have between about 70 and 90.
That's a good size population. Who do you minister to? What kind of people come to your services, which, of course, are outside of the official framework of the Catholic Church? So who are you ministering to?
At the beginning of our community, when it started, Jane could speak better to that. But the people who first came from Catholic churches that were more progressive but had recently taken a few steps to the right, mm-hmm. which left this gap in San Diego for progressive Catholics. And so the people that come to Mary Magdalene tend to be people who are Vatican II Catholics, which means they were hoping to see many reforms in the church, not just the ordination of women, but also changes in the liturgy and changes in who gets to come to the table for Eucharist.
Very interesting. Does your congregation include other people who may not be included within the traditional Catholic hierarchy? For example, are you ministering to gay people, divorced Catholics, things like that?
Yes, from the start, our mission was to reach out to those who are marginalized by the traditional church. So somebody recently said to me, said to us, that the center of Catholicism needs to be in the margins. And that's exactly where we hope and we feel that we are. So yes, so those who are marginalized, that would include divorced Catholics, remarried Catholics, LGBTQ Catholics, women.
Women who use birth control, maybe. Yeah.
Yes, certainly the birth control issue or those who just, as Jane often says, those who can no longer worship with integrity in a canonical parish.
Mm-hmm. So where does your congregation meet?
We meet at a Lutheran church, Gethsemane Lutheran Church in Sara Mesa. We rent space from them. They are an ELCA Lutheran mm-hmm. church.
And if people want to find out more information about you, where can they get that?
At our website at www.mmacc.org.
I'm looking at your qualifications, and it looks like you're certainly eminently qualified by many accounts. Nancy, I can see, the current pastor, besides your ordination and later excommunication, you hold a diploma in theology from Oxford University, one of the best in the world, and a Master of Divinity from San Francisco Theological Seminary of the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. Jane, tell us a little bit about your background.
I started life as a professor of religious studies, and I went to a Catholic university, Marquette University, where I got my doctorate with a specialty in New Testament studies.
What compelled you to take these courageous stances?
Over the years, I felt increasingly marginalized as a woman in the church. I was just sort of becoming an adult at the time of Vatican II, so I had big hopes for where the church was going and for changes that would come, which would include married clergy, women clergy, more flexibility with respect to liturgy, more flexibility with respect to doctrine and dogma, more authenticity within the church about our history. And none of those things happened after about 1978, 1980. There was a decided turn back towards the pre-Vatican II church. Mm-hmm. So I felt increasingly marginalized, and at the same time, I was teaching New Testament studies and learning when I'm teaching, preparing to teach, that Jesus was radically inclusive in his lifestyle and mission.
Yes.
And that much of the doctrine and dogma embraced in the Catholic Church is historical but post-biblical.
Very interesting. And Nancy, what about you?
I think I have an experience like many people. I heard about a community that was going to be convened in San Diego, and I was living in San Diego at the time, by a woman, a Roman Catholic priest, and a woman who was a deacon and was going to be ordained a priest. And like many people, I said, that can't be, or how can that be? I have to check this out. So I heard when the first liturgy was going to be, November 27th, 2005, and I showed up. And from that first liturgy, I had always felt in the church, I was getting increasingly a little bit like Jane, increasingly disillusioned with the church. And I wondered how the church could move into greater inclusivity in language, in practice, in ministry. And I didn't know how we would get there from here. And I walked into this church and it was there.
Yeah.
It had created the church of tomorrow that I had always dreamed might be. So that was my conversion, if you will.
It makes me think a lot of the civil rights movement, where it really took some acts of civil disobedience. Rosa Parks, mm-hmm. another courageous woman, sitting down on that bus and just saying, I'm not going to get off for the white guys. And look what happened as a result. Her and, of course, millions of other people who came to join and march and just demand equality. Let's talk about the current Pope, Pope Francis, who's certainly been rattling a lot of cages. Are there some changes that he has made thus far that you believe are positive for the church?
I believe that he has made some changes in attitude And in a spirit of generosity, or as is he called for, a year of mercy. So I do believe he has made some shifts that are very welcome mm-hmm. by the majority of lay people, that sort of attitudinal shifts towards inclusivity. However, he hasn't made any substantive changes. I think this call for the open commission on the study of whether or not women can be deacons is one of the first concrete things in the direction of inclusivity that he's done. The other things that he's done is, I think, created a spirit of welcome, or trying to create a greater spirit of welcome, but really nothing substantive has changed.
Yeah. Jane, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, he certainly has shifted the emphasis away from pomp and circumstance and authority to serving the marginalized. However, yeah. he does not perceive women to be among the marginalized in the church. He simply doesn't see it. On the other hand, if the only thing he did throughout his entire papacy were the encyclical on the environment, which is called Laudato Si, that would have been enough, because Catholics worldwide were really backwards with respect to environmental issues. He published that encyclical, and virtually overnight, the entire Catholic Church went into its formal teaching mode, and parishes all over the world are suddenly being called to become aware of the environmental issues, the importance yeah. of changing our lifestyles in order to protect the earth. So I think he's absolutely wonderful in those ways. And of course, he's an absolutely lovely man. Mm-hmm. He's a wonderful person and lived a very simple lifestyle in his own position of authority as Archbishop, and now as Pope, to the best he can. He lives a simple lifestyle relative to what
he
could.
The first Pope to come out of Latin America, and certainly his encyclical on climate change is earth-shattering and could wind up saving our planet if his words are heeded. That said, he has not come along, as you've pointed out, on the issue of women priests, maybe women deacons eventually, depending on what this panel decides. How hopeful are you that that too could change over time, that this Pope or some future one may eventually say that it's okay to have women ordained as priests? I mean, in some ways it makes a lot of sense, not only from an equality standpoint, but certainly the church has been rocked by one pedophilia scandal after another with male priests. You would think that logically maybe it might make sense to open it up to some women. But what are your thoughts on what hope do you have for the future on that?
I do have hope. I really believe that the church must change if it's going to survive, and I believe it will change. I don't think it's going to happen in my lifetime, but I do believe it will change. In the interim, I think the study that Pope Francis has proposed is a very important study, because if he brings in the scholars of the last 25 years, he's going to find that scholarship has really demonstrated that there are no barriers to women's ordination biblically, historically, and culturally.
So it was just something that was imposed by men way back in those early times.
Yes, in fact, you know, it's pretty well respected and accepted these days among Catholic scholars that there were women deacons, women priests, women bishops
really?
In the first century, particularly in the first 300 years, but like married clergy survived for a few centuries after the prohibition against married clergy in the Catholic Church. There were women who survived in leadership roles in the Catholic Church right up to and through the 9th and 10th centuries. And then there was this dramatic shift. According to scholar Gary Macy, there was a very dramatic shift in the 10th and 11th centuries, a very misogynistic shift towards the exclusion of women from any leadership roles of any kind.
Fascinating. It's like so much of history, it's written by men, and they tend to just write out the role of women. We've seen that over and over again, not just with the church, but in so many other things. I think I'd like to close today by reading a statement that the Mary Magdalene Apostle Catholic Community issued after the Pope's announcement about this panel to study whether women could be deacons or not. It noted that the Vatican typically proceeds at a glacial pace and concluded, quote, "Constant action from lay groups will determine whether the Vatican will progress at all or, absent solid action, whether they will freeze solid in the embrace of tradition. Embracing tradition will continue the second-class status of females in the Church, or Will this panel be the start of something really big? I'm going to let the two of you have the final word today. Is there anything else that you would like our listeners to know that I haven't already asked about?
One of the preeminent feminist theologians of the world, Rosemary Radford Ruther, was present at Nancy's ordination. When she was interviewed afterwards, she said, "This ordination is exactly the way ordinations were done in the second century in Rome in the Catholic Church."
A week before my ordination in 2009, in July, the Pope at the time, Pope Benedict XVI, had issued a long statement, but in that statement, he spoke about the grave crimes of the Church, and he listed pedophilia alongside the attempted ordination of women
wow.
as equally grave a sin.
That's really shocking.
Yeah.
And to date, none of the Catholic clergy who have been found to have engaged in pedophilia have been excommunicated.
Amazing. So I have to ask, you know, given that the Church has chosen to excommunicate all women who try to become priests, why have you formed your own Catholic parish, essentially? Why didn't you just leave the Church and go find a church that was more accepting of women pastors? There's many of them out there now that would allow that.
We often get asked the question, why don't you vote with your feet and leave the Church? And one of the reasons is that number of people who are Catholic, who are Roman Catholic, feel it in their bones. It's their DNA. It's what they were born Catholic and they're going
yeah.
to die Catholic. And it's part of who they are. We've had people come to our community who have gone to other denominations like an Episcopalian or Lutheran or another mainstream Protestant denomination. And somebody recently came to our church and said, even though I go to my Episcopalian church and I like it, there's something missing. Because it's not Catholic. I don't feel complete in my spiritual sacramental journey without being in a Catholic parish. So we're grateful we were there for that. That's one aspect of it.
Jane, how about you?
I think another aspect of it that's really important, and it certainly is what drives me, is that if every woman who is educated, intelligent, articulate, critical in her thinking, and able to speak out on behalf of women in the Catholic Church, if all of those people leave, who will call the Church to change? Once people leave the Catholic Church, the Vatican is free to completely ignore them. The fact that Roman Catholic women priests says, we are women priests and we are Roman Catholic, makes us a problem for the Vatican. It keeps the issue alive. It requires conversation. And who knows, perhaps some pope eventually will take action.
Very good point. Listeners, if you just tuned in, we have been speaking with Pastors Nancy Curran and Jane Villa from the Mary Magdalene Apostle Catholic Community right here in San Diego. Thank you so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show. I'm KNSJ.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Miriam. We appreciate your interest in this subject.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast for Friday, June 24th, 2016. I'm Mark Richardson. In our wrap-up of today's news, Great Britain has voted to leave the European Union. The Supreme Court issues major rulings on immigration and affirmative action, and the world's biggest swimming lesson aims at preventing drowning. In our top story, the British people have apparently voted to leave the European Union. The BBC called the election early Friday after the Leave votes took a strong lead with the vast majority of the votes counted. The outcome is likely to rock world financial markets today, and many believe it could be the beginning of the end for the European Union. Analysts say the loss will fall squarely on the shoulders of Prime Minister David Cameron, who campaigned to keep Britain in the 28-nation alliance with the rest of the continent. With more than 25 million votes cast, the Brexit campaign was leading by more than a million votes over those wanting to remain. Back home, immigration rights advocates are blasting the U.S. Supreme Court's decision Thursday, which, as Brandon Campbell reports, could doom President Barack Obama's expanded immigration policy.
In a tie vote, 4-4, the justices allowed a lower court decision to stand that prevents the president from shielding about 4 million people from deportation. The deferred action plans would give temporary protections to families with mixed immigration status and some who entered the country as children. Selena Villanueva with the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights says this decision will affect more than 500,000 undocumented immigrants in the state.
We want to protect families. At the end of the day, it isn't just about here, the state of Illinois, but it's about everybody across the country. Immigration affects us all, and we really need to deal with it, and we need immigration reform.
The lower court ruling came after Texas and 25 other states sued over the expanded immigration plans, which were announced 2 years ago. The states argued the president had overstepped his authority.
Oscar Juarez Luna with the Colorado Immigrant Rights Coalition says many immigrants found the court's decision gut-wrenching and are trying to figure out what to do next. He says he's personally benefited from the program and is worried for people like his brother, whose plans remain on hold.
It allowed me to professionally develop myself, continue my school education. My brother was someone who qualified for this program. His goals were always to have a better job and to contribute even more to the economy.
Juarez Luna says he hopes the high court decision motivates backers of comprehensive immigration reform to head to the polls in November. Meanwhile, members of the coalition have vowed to continue working to keep families together and end deportations. Vigils are planned tonight in both Denver and Pueblo. In another high-profile Supreme Court ruling Thursday, the justices ruled that the University of Texas can consider race as part of its admissions criteria in order to diversify its student body. The decision was an unexpected surprise for minority groups and advocates of affirmative action, but a defeat for Texas conservatives who had claimed the policy discriminates against white applicants. Philip Martin, deputy director of Progress Texas, says he hopes the ruling encourages other schools to diversify their student bodies.
We wish there would have been a ninth justice on the court, so there could have been a 9-member vote. That said, this decision does set precedent for the country, and we hope that universities, not just here in Texas, but across the entire United States, continue to look at using affirmative action in their admissions policies.
President Obama praised the decision, saying it doesn't guarantee equal outcomes, but promotes equal opportunities. A judge acquitted a Baltimore police officer Thursday, charged with murder and 6 other crimes in the death of Freddie Gray. The failure to get a conviction dealt a major blow to the prosecution in the case and raises questions about whether the state should press ahead with the trial of 4 other officers in the case. Officer Caesar Goodson Jr. drove the police transport van in which Gray suffered a spinal cord injury that killed him. He faced the most serious charges of any of the 6 officers indicted in the case. His acquittal leaves the state without any convictions after 3 trials. The first major overhaul of the Federal Toxic Substances Control Act has been signed into law.
President Obama signed the legislation Wednesday, vastly expanding the Environmental Protection Agency's authority to test and regulate the thousands of chemicals in daily use. Liz Hitchcock with Safer Chemicals, Healthy Families calls that a significant improvement.
The federal government now has the authority to take action on toxic chemicals that it has not had.
The original law, passed in 1976, made the cost of regulation a major consideration and set standards for scientific proof of harm that were so high the EPA was even blocked from regulating asbestos. I'm Andrea Sears reporting.
The world's largest swimming lesson is happening today to bring attention to drowning as the leading cause of death for children ages 1 through 4 in the United States.
Swimming lessons can reduce the risk of drowning by 88% among kids aged 1 to 4. To cap off Drowning Prevention Week, the Iowa Department of Public Health is offering the world's largest swimming lesson later this morning in Altoona as part of a nationwide program. Debbie Cooper is a senior environmental specialist with the department.
They'll do some basic things like blowing bubbles in the water, front float, back float, how to get in the water properly, how to get out of the water properly. It's very, very general, but we really hope to raise awareness of the importance of swimming lessons.
Cooper says they're hoping to help break the record by being one of many lesson locations across the U.S. The world's largest swimming lesson begins at 9:30 this morning at the Altoona Campus Aquatic Park. Bob Kessler reporting.
And that's the news. I'm Mark Richardson for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
In the good old summertime, in the good old summertime, crawling through the shady lane with your baby mine.
she hold yours, and that's a very good sign. That she don't hope she won't see in the good old summertime.
This is a public service announcement from the County of San Diego. As temperatures climb, it's important to stay cool. Seniors and those without air conditioning are particularly vulnerable to heat-related illness. The county has provided a list of cool zones where you can beat the heat, including places in East County, such as libraries and senior centers. All are free and open to the public during designated hours. You can find a list of school zones in your area at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
This is Leon Thompson with the Health Report. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has approved Vaxchora, a vaccine for the prevention of cholera caused by serogroup 01 in adults 18 through 64 years of age traveling to cholera-infected areas. Vaxchora is the only FDA-approved vaccine for the prevention of cholera. Vaxchora is a live, weakened vaccine that is taken as a single oral liquid dose of approximately 3 fluid ounces at least 10 days before travel to a cholera-affected area. Vaxchora is manufactured by PaxVax Bermuda Limited, located in Bermuda. Cholera, a bacterial disease, is acquired by consuming contaminated water or food. It can cause severe diarrhea that is potentially life-threatening if treatment with antibiotics and fluid replacement is not initiated promptly. According to the World Health Organization, serogroup 01 is the predominant cause of cholera globally. While cholera is rare in the U.S., travelers to part of the world with inadequate water and sewage treatment and poor sanitation are at risk for infection. Up until now, travelers to cholera-infected areas have had to rely on preventative strategies recommended by the CDC to protect themselves against cholera, including safe food and water practices and frequent hand washing. Double-blind, placebo-controlled tests of Vaxchora on adults, volunteers in the U.S. and Australia, found the vaccine to be effective in 80 to 93% of those who received the vaccine and who were exposed to cholera. The most common adverse reactions reported were tiredness, headache, abdominal pain, nausea, vomiting, lack of appetite, and diarrhea. The FDA granted the Vaxchora application fast track designation and priority review status to expedite development and a review of medical products that addresses a serious or life-threatening condition.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show. This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.